All right, this is Free the Land. We're going to interrupt that other program. We have Gene in the studio. She serves food at Food Not Bombs. She served food all throughout Occupy. She continues the revolution.
Is it on?
Yeah, they're all on.
Okay. Well, thank you for, we ran into each other early today and inviting me to come by, and we'll hope not to embarrass myself by anything I may or may not know.
So what brought you to the revolution, Gene? How did you get into politics?
Very slowly, and not till my probably mid-30s, and most of it's been here in Santa Cruz County, if the truth be known.
Mm-hmm.
Like a lot of folks, got organized around United Farm Workers Support Action.
I see. They were doing those loudspeakers in the fields?
Well, actually, Cesar Chavez came and spoke at Cabrillo, and this is what happens when they pass around a sign-up sheet and you actually put contact information.
And then you get drawn in.
There you go. So I started just helping with some of the informational picketing and along those lines, and that was in probably the mid-70s.
Where were you picketing?
We went to different markets where we saw they were carrying products, and
this is the grape pickets?
No, I think that had probably, if there was, it was, you know, towards the end of the grape boycott.
Okay.
So
you'd go in front of the supermarkets, and
yeah.
How did the public respond?
Well, you know, you get your fair amount of supporters and people who just want to shop wherever they can without any thought of having to raise their consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
So
what happened after the boycotts ended? What did you do then?
Well, actually, I think it was in 76, there was Prop 14, which was put on the ballot to try and solidify the Agricultural Labor Relations Act, which I think was pretty much just put in under then Governor Jerry Brown, who was pretty empathetic to
back then. Now he's a Nazi.
The farm worker movement.
He moves with the times, like all good politicians. You know, they don't really have any beliefs of their own. They just jump in front of the parade.
Anyway.
Now he's all against crime, but he wants to send all the criminals to the local areas, back to their own jails, instead of have to pay for it himself. Much like Reagan didn't want to pay for all the crazy people, so he kicked them out of the insane asylums. So you're working on this to stop this amendment or to support it?
Support it. I think the fact was that, well, the kind of rejoinder when we approached people about the Agricultural Labor Relations Act was that, well, it's already here, you know. Why have a petition drive or proposition when it's already on the books? But, you know, things are on the books one
can
year
disappear.
And off the... Yeah.
Oh, so you mean the legislator put it on the books.
Yeah.
But you wanted to make sure that it stayed.
Right.
For a constitutional amendment, you can do it with in this state, you can do it with enough signatures, which is I consider that anarchism, because it's the people doing it.
It was on the ballot, but it went down in defeat. I don't recall how... But, you know, there was all kinds of grower money to combat.
Did they use the standard technique of putting a whole bunch of other ones on the ballot that were sounded like it, were confusing?
I don't think so. I don't recall that.
Latest technique.
Yeah,
they learned that over the years. You'll get there like six or seven, and you can't tell which is the good one from all the bad ones. Yeah.
But that was kind of a neat experience, because it actually went down... Well, I spent a summer down at their headquarters, Keene, which is between Bakersfield and Tehachapi, and what started out as just helping out, then they shifted everybody to different areas to work on Prop 14.
So what techniques did you go in front of shopping centers, door to door?
Yeah, mostly shopping centers, some door-to-door. I remember some we were down in Southern California in the general Los Angeles area. And going to somebody's door who was very hostile and threatening.
No, you get a very conservative area down there.
Well,
right?
Wherever we were, this person didn't want any. He didn't want to hear about it, and he threatened to take out his gun if we didn't leave. You know, but that was a bit on the extreme side. So.
Well, that's interesting. So then, so after that, what did you get into?
I came back up to Santa Cruz and. I think somewhere around that time of the, towards the end of the 70s, or the very early 80s, I was mentioning you, to you today, I joined the local Communist Party.
Oh, you became a commie.
Yeah.
Started waving the red flag?
We did that. We, you know, did a lot of petitioning at one point every so many years to get Gus Hall on the ballot for president.
He's a communist. Like, that was ever going to happen.
Yeah.
They're never going to elect a communist.
Exactly. And Angela,
they won't even elect a woman back then. You know?
Yeah. Well, Angela Davis, on one of those four-year election runs, was running as a vice president, and she had a lot of popularity.
On the communist ticket?
Crossover popularity.
She still teaches up here at the university, right?
I guess. I thought she had retired.
Okay, maybe she retired. She was teaching up here for a long time.
And so, I mean, you know, I was pretty much a rank and file, I wouldn't say I have the world's
card carrying?
Oh, definitely. There was a card and you paid your dues and you got a little stamp.
You have to pay dues to be a communist. It's like a free radio show. You could have had a free radio show for less.
It was only $1, so I mean, they didn't want it to be a hardship for anybody.
But well, in the 70s, that's like $20 now, so it's still something. What, is that a year for a membership, for a buck?
A month.
A month, so $12 a year.
Yeah, you had your little red book and a red sticker.
You got to go to all the communist parties?
We could, yeah. We went up to
the what do you need the card for, anyways? That's what I want to know.
I don't know. Feel good, right?
Yeah.
So what's official?
I see. Did you ever have a cop go through your ID and find it or anything?
No.
Yeah, okay.
Managed to avoid a lot of confrontation.
Because,
really.
I mean, communists were hated back then, right?
Well, more so, I think,
in the 50s,
for sure. Whatever they could drum up, probably, around communists and the Vietnamese.
So what attracted you to communism? How did you sign up?
Well, they were attracted to me, actually.
They came in.
Yeah, they saw me as...
kind of like the Jehovah's Witnesses, they came up to you and tried to get you involved.
Right, there's that aspect, but... you get invited to kind of an open meeting, and a prominent person visited and gave us the CP sales pitch, basically, and I just,
How did they recruit you? Like, off the street? Did they do tabling? Because of your work with
We're involved in local actions. We crossed paths.
I see. So they got to know you.
I was rather, could get in people's faces a little bit. I wasn't particularly shy. Now I take a little more of a back seat. I'd say sometimes I'm just the warm body in the street or the room to help the cause, but... you know, one thing I will say, whatever, and rightly so, criticisms there may be or have been around the Communist Party, the individuals and the work that some individuals did with the party was really yeoman's efforts on behalf of working people against racism, a certain internationalism, it's a nice introduction into a bigger picture of politics. It wasn't single-issue politics where, you know...
Yeah, I prefer a general... Today, everybody seems to be on single-issue pretty much.
Yeah.
Or whatever's in the news right now is whatever the rallies around.
the activism du jour, kind of. Not to discredit it, but, you
know. It's all about, if you achieve anything, in my view, you know, and so if you're just doing that, you're just playing at it. I mean, you have to achieve. You have to work hard. And it's not just, you just don't show up and hold a sign for a little bit. It requires a lot of work. You have to figure out how to beat the other side, because you're opposed by the capitalists and others.
Yeah.
So you have to figure out how to beat them. To me, it's like playing games or whatever. There's a strategy you can win with, or you can sit there and lose all day.
Well, I mean, perhaps in this area, to a certain extent, people are more informed around a variety of issues and see, I mean, it's hard mm-hmm. not to see the bigger picture of global capitalism mm-hmm. and Wall Street, the banks here, to feel there's more than just one issue out there. It's all
they're interrelated.
Connected.
Yeah, they are. They're interrelated.
So
that's for sure. And it usually revolves around money or some, you know.
Yeah, well, you know.
Even the conservatives, they have an ideology, but they're really about the money.
Yeah, it's kind of like a cancer, I think. The more you have, the more you want to hold on and not mm-hmm. take less, mm-hmm. which less would be some other people's 10 lifetimes before.
Yeah, well, they want more, too. I mean, they got more than they can ever spend, but they still want more, because there's also power that goes with it, too, and that's also very addicting, as well as the wealth. So you joined the Communist Party. So what kind of actions did you do then?
Well, let's see. With some labor actions, some solid
strikes.
Yeah, supportive of really a game changer. One of the game changers politically in Watsonville was the cannery strike. And I always, you know, mention that with folks who weren't around here then or mm-hmm. just unfamiliar. What an important strike that was. And it went on for about a year and a half.
Is this in the 80s?
Yeah, from 85 to 86.
Uh-huh. And it was over working conditions?
Yeah, yeah. And they were introducing, for one thing, you know, workers had been used to reasonable hourly wage, and we're going to drop the hourly wage, which eventually
they dropped the wage.
Yeah,
start paying less and less, and this is while inflation is going more and more. So you're really getting hit with a double whammy then.
Yeah, and you know, people had families, housing, mm-hmm. kids they were sending to school.
Were they also mechanizing too and laying people off because of that?
You know, I'm not sure if that was particularly something that affected work in the fields. The canneries, you know, and canneries at one point, I think, were a bigger item perhaps than they are now. But, you know, I saw the statistic this isn't a recent statistic, but about 10,000 trucks, semis, go through Watsonville on a regular basis.
Is that per month or?
It might even be more than that.
Per week?
You know, I mean, there's still a lot of trucking.
Well, there's a lot of agriculture in that area still.
And there's still coolers and frozen food coolers down there.
So what happened in the strike? Was it contentious? Was there violence?
You know, really, none of the workers crossed the picket line.
That's good.
There were probably more women strikers than men, because all of these assembly lines are pretty much women on the line.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, John Silver, who's still here locally, did this, what became an award-winning documentary called Watsonville on Strike. And that, I think it can probably get it through the Santa Cruz Library system.
Maybe it's on YouTube or something, too.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I think someone checked it out and there's reference to it.
Mm-hmm.
It won awards because of women mm-hmm. engaged in it. It won labor awards. So
this lasted a year and a half, and there was, what happened? What was the result?
Well, you know, the workers were ready to go back to work, and they were instructed, hey, hang on just a little bit longer because maybe we can hold out for better health care and not totally give away too much. Mm-hmm. And in fact, they did hold out, and they came out a little better as a result of holding out for an additional week. And, you know, just during that time when that strike was going on, I remember Jesse Jackson came down. And, you know, it was not uncommon for 3,000 people to show up in Callahan Park or Ramsey Park.
Yeah. You just know. Don't get that kind of support anymore around here.
Yeah, the last I saw was around. I mean, I did see some prior to and around the Iraq War, but the immigration rallies for that period when they were really being organized and people were coming out. I mean, it drew a lot of folks out in Watsonville.
Mm-hmm. Is this in the 80s still you're talking about,
no,
or recently?
No, this was one of the rallies in the 90s by then.
90s? I don't get down there too much. That is more of a working class area.
2000s.
Santa Cruz isn't a working class area.
Yeah, no, I know. People,
it's academic, mostly.
Far to
and retail.
Go.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, I don't discredit the work that activists at UC do. Mm-hmm. You know, Sin Bades, I think, probably. Mm-hmm. I don't know if they started up there, but
it was like a reading group. We had them on a couple of weeks ago. It's archived at Free the Land.
They do good work.
Ready for All. Yeah, they do. They're fighting a tough cause.
I mean,
like, okay, it's going to be, I don't know what. They want to end prisons, and it's like, there's no support for that. But they may be able to get some reforms or something. Basically, if they get people into the jails to see what's going on and get that out to the public, that would be a huge thing. That would stop a lot of the torture and all that other stuff.
Yeah, but it's kind of interesting if you look at Holder, was it last week? They're going to redo or try to reduce those mandatory minimum laws that put people, unfairly, people of color, it would seem, into jails and prisons.
Well, they have to now because the federals said that the states are way overcrowded, so Jerry Brown moved everybody into the county, and now they can't put, you know, people in jail for sleeping here anymore.
Yeah.
So they're going to have to lower everybody's minimums or build more jails, and that's expensive. So
right.
So I think they might just have to stop busting people for silly things. Just focus on the, you know, violent crime or the kind of crime that everyone agrees is crime.
Right. I mean, you know, just in terms of the local police and the criticism, at least I've heard and a little bit I've seen, how much of manpower, police power, is off doing, you know, minimal things.
Oh, yeah. A friend of mine went and complained there, and she said they had cops doing administrative work that a secretary could have done much better. And these are guys that are making, you know, over $70,000 a year, and they're going to retire at 90% of their pension. It's just poor. This city is very, very poorly run on all levels. Because everybody wants to live here, so that you need a job. And well, the way you get jobs in Santa Cruz is you know somebody, which means you don't get jobs by merit. You get it because you know somebody. So everybody's doing a poor job.
Well,
I will say, you know, controversial things like that. It isn't always completely true. It's a vast generalization.
Yeah.
But in general, it's my experience that that's the case. I've heard people complain about the restaurants, same thing. So so you said at some point you said you quit the Communist Party?
There was a big big falling out, I suppose, and that was in 91. 1991.
Is this a local thing or is this international?
No, it affected mostly probably the largest populations of CPers would have been in New York and the Bay Area. And our club was part of the regional Bay Area.
So you were in a national group that had a smaller area around here.
Yeah, no, I mean, they're regional districts. They're you know, organizers that focus, for example, around the Bay Area, and that sort of thing. And, you know, I think mostly the simple way that I saw it, or recall it, was that a lot of party folks realized there's a lot of issues out there And we need to expand into some of these other issues, environmental issues,
instead of strictly mostly labor, is that...
Labor, racism,
No, I'm saying, what was the Communist Party focusing too much on and not enough on?
Yeah.
They definitely were going labor, because that's part of their platform, right?
Yeah.
So what other things were they doing before?
Yeah, I did a lot of anti-racism work.
Anti-racism.
It was a very key component from the get-go with commies.
Yeah.
So, but, you know, they were...
But they weren't doing much environmental...
Gender issues, environmental issues, and, you know, the party got... I mean, after the split,
yeah.
I think nationally the party then was making this appeal to all these other causes because...
They were losing membership because of the union thing wasn't as important. Because a lot of the places that can be unionized are already unionized. I mean, it requires a lot of people... In one place, like, it's very hard to unionize retail because there's a few people in each store. Whereas a manufacturing plant, there's a whole bunch of people.
Yeah,
or the buses, they're all unionized.
Yeah. But they were, you know, really slow, in my opinion, my simple opinion, to see that times were changing and you had to have bigger appeal.
Why, to the general population?
Yeah, and it was hard to...
But now, I mean, communism is like... Of the people we know that are activists, very few are communists. There's a whole bunch of self-proclaimed anarchists, but very few communists. And so what happens? So they switched issues and then they just lost membership still?
Yeah, and I mean, for the Bay Area and probably the New York City area, they formed committees of correspondence for democracy and socialism and... you know, so people are still engaged. They're not only, weren't only people who were party people, but, you know, hopefully casting a broader appeal to people.
So you actually just quit altogether? You didn't join the new...
Well, yeah, I'm part of it. I mean, I pay my dues. I'm
you still got that card, huh?
Well, no, there's no card.
No card? Oh, that's why. That's why. Without the card, communism is nothing. They got to bring back the card.
That would be a curiosity piece.
Collector's item.
Yeah.
The capitalists will pay big money for it someday. But maybe that is, you know, stuff like that, you know, patches, kind of people search to identify, because it does seem like the Communist Party went away. This is also 91, though, 2 years after the, you know, fall of the Berlin Wall, so it could be part of the Soviets were actually behind it all, and no one knew it, and then as soon as they were gone, the whole thing fell apart.
A lot of people really, I wouldn't say a lot, but I've heard friends I know, and they... bemoan Gorbachev because they feel like he made some big blunders in trying to open up communism, right? Perestroika was called back then. I don't know. I mean, I think when you look at the turmoil in general and upheaval going on in the Middle East and other parts of the world, I mean, there, to a certain extent, I'm under the impression that, you know, the Communist Party still has some basic footholds with third world or developing countries.
You mean today? Today?
Yeah.
Well, there's still a relationship with Syria and the Soviet Union, and they're not backing down, so there's could be some conflict coming up here soon.
But I can see, you know, the criticisms against... the party per se, but I think the saving grace was a lot of the membership, the people who were, you know, steady doing it all the time.
So you still do it, but you're not in the party anymore, is that?
You know, my role, I don't know, I guess when you get down to feeding people, let people see you in this big light, I never made more of my political activity than I felt it deserved compared to the work I see people done for years and years and years. And, you know, like to say I coined the term slacktivist because I know when to back off and not show up, you know. I'm not so inclined to want to be everywhere.
I wouldn't call you a slack. I mean, because you're, that's why I've had you on here. I mean, I see you all the time. I mean, you were at Occupy all the time. You've continued to feed people through Food Not Bombs, whereas, you know, the rest of all the occupiers, the fatticals have disappeared. You know, it's pretty much mostly Huff there at the meetings these days.
Well, you know, Occupy, I was there, but in reality, I think the period of my efforts were 2 or 3 months. But, you know.
Well, that's it only lasted a couple of months, really.
After that.
I mean, the camp, I mean, you were doing the feeding, so that there was only feeding for a couple months. And then the cops came and stole everybody's property. There's some real criminals there. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but so you're still active, I mean.
Yeah, well, it's easier. Some of it is easier. We're trying to kind of recharge a certain plateau we've hit at Food Not Bombs.
Oh, tell us a little bit about Food Not Bombs. So it got reorganized after Occupy.
Yeah, and Monica, who had been part of Food Not Bombs, and Coral, I know, has a history with Food Not Bombs, but...
Remember Roxanne was doing some stuff?
Yeah,
she had some meetings at her house. She has a child now, though, so she doesn't have the time anymore.
Monica approached Occupy about maybe helping with Food Not Bombs.
Because Casey was also, he started up a Food Not Bombs before Occupy. Yeah. Nobody was doing it for a while. That's the thing about Food Not Bombs, it tends to die out and then somebody gets, leader appears and starts to do it again, although it's supposed to be non-leader.
There was one fellow, it's interesting, I gotta say about Food Not Bombs, when people come up, it's kind of like people who were... when they were kids or something, they remember going around collecting for UNICEF. There are people who say, oh man, I helped the Food Not Bombs, whether it was Santa Cruz or Berkeley or some other state. There are a lot of people who pass through Food Not Bombs because they do come up and say, you know, they had been involved. I think... one fellow here said, oh, I was with Food Not Bombs, and said, well, how'd that go? And he said, well, you know, he did it for 6 months. I ran into someone last week who did it here for a year. Mm-hmm. And he said, but then it became a core group, and you burn out.
A core group? Oh, just fewer and fewer people?
Yeah, and we're a little in that stage.
Oh, you're getting to there now, eh?
But, you know, when Keith came through, I don't know if it was the last time or the time before, and we approached him with that, how do you avoid burnout?
Mm-hmm.
And I thought he said something that made good sense. He said, well, if you're just doing it for charity, you're going to burn out.
You're going to burn out, yeah.
But if you're doing it with political politics in mind...
You got to have those flyers on the table. You know, you got to have... You know, it doesn't have to be... He said it doesn't have to be about any particular... It doesn't have to be the bomb spot, but any kind of politics that gets people involved in talking about it.
Yeah.
I mean, the Occupy cleverly moved their meetings to right next to Food Not Bombs. They were doing it on Sunday, and now they
Yeah.
I think it needs to combine an action with the meeting or the politics. Because a meeting alone is boring.
Right.
And you need two to get to charge people up.
I don't know how many. I don't think there's a huge spillover of people who come to eat and people.
It's like Dennis.
Yeah, stick around for a meeting, you know.
Right.
At any rate, you know, some of the things we've talked about and have started to do, even just with tabling informational, and got plenty of printed material to make available for people, so people want to do more of that. Dan has brought up an idea that sounds really good, maybe doing some action in support of fast food workers, and that may develop.
That's a good one.
Yeah.
And Keith McHenry was saying one of the best places to do food not bombs is near a fast food restaurant, because they've already done all the research on the people traffic and everything, and those are usually good spots to give away food.
Yeah.
So that would be ideal to set one up near Taco Bell or something, and then you'll get the police hassling you too.
Also. Yeah, I don't know, you know, if necessarily the idea was to serve it up, but to, you know, just for sure do some informational leafleting, which is different than picketing. And I think we might be able to generate some interest around that issue. And it's highly visible. Look at all the fast food places, right?
That's mostly what's that's the industry, and in, other than the university in this town, is the fast food, the tourists, and, you know, the boardwalk and everything. So another thing is to, you know, is make it part of a party or something, so it's more enjoyable. You're not just feeding people that don't give a shit about you or anything, but you're, I mean, a lot of the Occupy would eat at Food Now Bombs too.
Yeah. Well, you know, in terms of the folks we're serving, and that number fluctuates depending on time of month and if people get an SSI check or, you know, it's erratic. You can't tell. It could start off fast and then, boom, you know, you've pretty much fed everybody in 30 or 40 minutes.
Yeah, sometimes you run out quick. I've noticed that.
Yeah. Well, or, you know, like last Saturday, it started late and boom, people showed up. So it's a fine line on if we give people seconds and thirds sometimes, you know. But I just want to say, you know, as painful visual images for me, I've seen two people. One, an older woman several weeks ago, gotten there. Well, she did eat, but then I saw her go through, you know, our trash.
Yeah, looking for some food you were throwing away.
Yeah, so, you know, we got something left. Bread.
We usually do, yeah.
Yeah, and to pass it along. And then a man 2 weeks ago, and he said, am I too late? He said, yeah, you know, and I'm going to look up, and there he is with a plate of food and a plate he fished out of the trash bag. And, you know, you hate to see people so down that they get to that. We always figure out something to do.
Well, it's because food stamps, they're not there to get people on food stamps. They're there to try and deny it the first time you make any kind of mistake. In fact, I've heard this one just automatically kicks people off from time to time, just so it's harder for them to get back on.
Well, is this big cutback, wasn't that one of the trade-offs, or isn't that a potential trade-off, cutbacks in the farm bill?
But I mean, this is like, I mean, you can still get food stamps, but I mean, this local group here, whoever the bureaucrats running it, are always trying to kick people. That's what I hear.
Yeah. I mean, what are you going to do?
Yeah, and then what do they have? Then they have the churches or Food Not Bombs, and then the churches, you know, it's like
1,000 points of light.
Yeah, right.
George's pappy used to call it. So, I mean, I have friends who are post, as anarchists are, I'm sure, opposed to big government, and I see some value in folks I know who talk about decentralized government, but on the big areas that could make, at least over a short period of time, some significant difference in people's lives, you know, our hurricane, right? I mean, fucked up FEMA, but, I mean, those agencies that can mobilize quickly on behalf of people, and I think, you know, it's almost like if you talk about some federal jobs, you know, you can't talk about that without mentioning the private sector help working in conjunction with the federal government, but I mean, it's such a massive downturn in this country over such an extended period of time. You know, just plain common sense.
Are you talking about the economy?
Yeah, if more people have some money in their pockets from work.
Well, that's the swing to the right. It's like, you know, the money all went to the rich, and they just invest it, you know, and if there's not money to make, they don't invest it. Whereas if you give it to poor people, they'll spend it, and then it'll get turned over a bunch of times, and that'll make everybody money. You know, it's just bad economic policy. I mean, economics is highly politicized. by them just taking most of the pie themselves, they're shooting themselves in the foot too, because they could make more money if everybody else was richer, as you said, because who actually produces the wealth? It's the people and the resources, putting the resources into and intellectual, you know, design, technology. So if people aren't working, and that's what's happening in this economy, fewer and fewer people are working, you're producing less wealth, so that there's less to go around altogether.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure there are a lot of people, man, they're either underemployed or they gave up a long time ago.
Yeah, and it's like, and then you got the idiots running things that don't know what they're doing, you know, so you end up, I know when I used to work, you know, I would be not really productive work because the management didn't know what they were doing. You know, you'd have to do it over again a lot of times. It's just because the people in management aren't there because they have any ability. It's just because they're good at politics, or their daddy gave them a bunch of money, or, you know, they're a member of the Masons or something.
Well, I mean, smart, at least at one point in time, and maybe this happens in the tech industry, that, you know, people come up with ideas, mm-hmm. whether collectively or individually.
That's the technology part, yeah.
You know, and then to the benefit of the company and to the benefit of the workers.
Although everybody, you know, like the light bulb or something benefits everybody. Yeah, although, you know, in this situation, those people aren't getting to do that anymore. I mean, during the boom, they maybe did, but now there's no interest in that. Plus, it also threatens, like, you know, the oil companies don't want to see any kind of other form of transportation than what we're using, even though electricity is a much more efficient way. It's cheaper, less polluting. It means less deaths overseas. But they will, you know, they'll kill people to stop stuff like that.
Yeah, and then spend $100,000 a day for a week to place "We're the Good Guys" type of an ad in the New York Times, you know, to convince everybody they're doing it for us.
You mean the wars?
Well, no, just the fact that they keep producing oil and gas for
they're doing
people.
It for us, yeah. It's like, yeah, nice. The wealthy are job creators, too.
Yeah.
There's always work to do. And so you were saying earlier about the government, you need a larger group too, not just a local small collective.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I guess the 30s, you know, were probably such difficult time for people that the government, however short-lived to a certain extent, rebuilding America was. Mm-hmm. I mean, the statistics of the number of schools and libraries and bridges and roads and you name it. I mean, that's the engine.
That's what America was strong.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it was the same thing that we're going through happened before the 30s. You know, globalization is really what causes it. Because they just move the jobs to wherever the cheaper people are. And that could be because they're undeveloped. It could be because they're, you know, under repressive regimes and can't ask for more wages. And yeah, like right now, China is booming, but they're already moving jobs away from China to other places because China's starting to get too expensive now, too. So it's... And then it eventually leads to, like, the 30s. We're going through a 30s kind of a similar cycle thing right here now. It's, yeah, and then you need a war to get the spending to get into individual pockets. And then I think they did a really good program after the end of the war with the, you know, the college bills or whatever.
GI Bill of Rights.
Yes. So they got people trained for more skills. And also everybody else was crushed, so we were able to export tons and make all the money. Right now we're competing with everybody else, especially China and India, I guess, because they have cheaper labor for now.
I mean, there was that example that it could be done in government, you needed government to do it. And I think, you know, that at least in the West Coast or pockets of the country, people are opting for alternatives that work for them, that isn't to keep reinforcing consumption, mm-hmm. and how you can get by in a healthy, decent way without being too locked into the system. I mean, a cooperative movement sounds pretty interesting.
Well, there was a lot of that happening in the 70s too, you know, as well as now. But like you said, you're still limited because you're still within the larger framework of the government, only your voice isn't being heard there anymore. You've taken it out. So therefore, it's the corporates and the capitalists are totally running our government with very little opposition. I mean, even like Obama, he's like a Republican would be 40 years ago. Mm-hmm. Bush is like a Nazi, right. You know, and you know, there is no liberal anymore.
Yeah. Well, you know, I just don't, you know, I personally think that Obama and his family, they're decent people. Mm-hmm. I think the machinery of the state, it's almost impossible to try and change, for example, the military-industrial complex. Those things are so
entrenched,
in. Mm-hmm. You know,
it's difficult. He's only there for a short time because the bureaucrats are there forever. So they're the ones who are really running it.
Even if he wanted to make some decent changes, there aren't.
The healthcare thing is a decent. I mean, it's as best as he could do. I'm surprised he got anything out of that, considering what he was up against. But I mean, he's for offshore. He used to be for offshore drilling, nuclear power. You know, school vouchers for school kids. Those are all Republican platform. You know, it's not. And Jerry Brown, same thing. He used to be, you know, moonbeam back in the 70s, and now he's, you know, comes in as from the attorney general spy. You know, he's Mr. Law and Order, and he's not answering his phone calls on the hunger strike in the prisons or anything. And that's partly the media too. I mean, the media has been shifted to the right. You know, it used to be that you had to provide an equal point of view. You just couldn't push one side, but they changed all those rules. And then the banking stuff, there used to be, they weren't allowed to be involved in investment banking and do home loans and stuff. But they got rid of all the things that changed in the 30s. They got rid of and exactly the same stuff happens. You need the government to regulate the banks. They can never regulate themselves because they can print money up. You
dirty
know,
just, word, regulation now. But that was...
it's absolutely required for banks. There's no way, otherwise they'll always fail.
Coming through and with for sure the Reagan administration, Naomi Klein spells it out in the shock doctrine. Deregulation, privatization, and you know, at some point just lack of enough funds for social safety net programs.
Oh yeah, they want to cut that. Oh, especially Social Security. Because more people are going to be retiring, and they don't want to pay that. And then the Medicare too. Well, the Medicare, a lot of that money is going to doctors and drug manufacturers. You know, I mean, communist countries have much more efficient.
It's interesting.
Cost for healthcare.
You know, in terms of, you know, I've been using Medicare. I don't use it a lot, but as an example, around medicine, I take one non-expensive thyroid pill, right? Mm-hmm. And I usually go to clinics because I figure people are doing their work with some nonprofit, hopefully serve the community interests. And the doctor said, well, we should put you on a 340B plan. Well, what is that? It's, you know, they have an agreement with the federal government in buying medicine. They can offer it, you know, like a 4-month supply. My medicine costs basically $20.
340B?
Mm-hmm.
Some of my medicine's expensive. I mean, something I was buying for $10 is like over 100. Yeah. What the hell?
For yourself.
Well, no, I mean, when I was buying it myself, and now I'm on this program or something, maybe a different manufacturer. I don't know. It's hard, though, to you deal with that bureaucracy at all. The minute you get outside their little boxes, the same thing with a corporate bureaucracy, then you're just, you know, you're screwed. It's just, you got to go keep going back and back, and they can never fix it. And I try and just not rock the boat with any of that stuff and stay within their main channel of whatever they do.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. I mean, you know, I keep my life pretty simple.
That's what I'm saying. Yeah, keep it simple. Because otherwise, you're standing in line forever at those things. And
if you have money, you get, speaking personally, you get used to, like, trying to find the best bargain, you know?
Yeah, exactly. So. That's what they should do, you know, but who knows what...
I mean, you know, I think, and I look at a lot of people, and I have to say, perhaps younger people, because they growing up in an uber age of consumer products, you know, And I mean, I feel like, you know, you're wearing the brand, you're promoting the brand.
I know, I used to cut the labels off. Screw that. So I'm not going to be an advertisement for those guys.
So. But what else here? Let me turn around and look at the time. You have some other stuff you want to get to?
I mean, no, what else are you into politically? You're doing the food not bombs?
Yeah, not a whole lot. I'm a supporter of immigration. I'm kind of involved with SCORE, anti-racism group. I can't say I make any big contributions to that organization, but, you know, I'm trying to raise consciousness in Santa Cruz County around institutional forms of racism, which would seem to me in a county like this, since it's mostly Latino who are affected by that. There isn't too many African Americans that probably...
there aren't that many in this town, really.
University probably has a larger black community than most of Santa Cruz. But I saw the NAACP sent around a mailer. Apparently, I think it's going to be a House bill to address racial profiling on a national level. And, you know, that's probably an offshoot.
We're talking about the cops mostly, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean...
The cops are probably racist here, I'm sure.
You know, most white people, you know, unless you're... I don't want to say it, but we don't live in that kind of world unless, you know, you're poor and you're out in the streets otherwise.
Well, there's a lot of prejudice against the homeless, but that's allowed because they're not considered a suspect class, because they could suddenly become wealthy and not be poor anymore.
Well, let me know.
I think the opposite is more true. I mean, somebody who's wealthy you can discriminate against because they can always give it away and become poor.
I did work for a nonprofit years ago for about a year, and the staff would work. These were folks who were homeless folks and may have had also substance abuse issues, right?
There's a lot
mental
of
mental health issues, for sure. And when they won the confidence of some of the people they were assisting, people who were like afraid of dealing with the government and what have you, they got people on SSI and they got back checks for thousands of dollars, you know? And I mean, you know, a lot of times what's out there now for people is probably a whole lot less, but I see a lot of people who are struggling with certain mental health issues that probably don't avail themselves.
They can't. I mean, and like I said, like food stamps kicks them off because they know they're not able to get back on again. They do need some kind of help to get on that stuff.
Yeah. So, I mean, the ombudsman would be a good paid position for the whomever to put out there and assist people. I think nonprofits try, you know.
Well, then, I mean, it's how do you reach? You have to actually go to, you know, the Red Church or Food Not Bombs in order to find the clientele or the homeless service center.
You know, but the other thing is I've seen this in low-income communities, and I lived in Watsonville or that area for a lot of years as well, that people, when they discover a resource, they share that with
their friends and stuff.
Because you know they're all
that's how people
struggling.
Learn stuff. Yeah, they're not going to trust somebody that just walks in off the street who knows what, but they trust their friends. So one person learns and they'll spread it around their whole
and
network.
And I don't know if that's the same. I would think at least on some resources, in terms of homeless people, letting folks know if they're new in town or whatever.
You know, I've said Huff should print some kind of a pamphlet, especially like what not to do downtown, because everything's illegal downtown. It's like a minefield if you're from out of town. You see people spare changing, but if you try it, you're in the wrong spot. You know, $250 ticket, you can't renew your registration on your van that you're living in. So yeah, you don't see those people coming to town quite as much as you used to, just get the hardcore.
Robert, with his recorder, definitely seems to interview a lot of folks.
He's more of a newsman than a, you know, than a, you know, service provider.
Yeah. I mean,
but I think your idea is correct. There needs to be some kind of organizations that can help people. And, you know, and for activism, too. I think there needs to be some kind of organisms to help activists become better activists. Because, I felt I wasted a whole lot of time at Occupy, and I'm still pissed about it. Because nothing happened at Occupy, really. Except for, like, the stuff you're doing. I mean, Brent's still trying to get the camp going. You're doing the food part.
Yeah, well, you know, how do you sustain movements should be a big question, and especially when the police and the local governments want you to disperse.
Yeah, but we saw that in the 60s. I mean, there was tear gas every other week at People's Park in Berkeley, but that didn't stop anybody. They just kept going. Mm-hmm. Something, it just, now it's just a couple months, it's over. Back to something else. There's no tenacity. Like I said, you've got tenacity. I don't see that in a lot of other activists. I mean, there's a few of us, but yeah, like when on Occupy, I go, who are all these people? I've never seen them before.
Well, at first it was very stimulating.
Yeah, it was nice. Kind of, this is the revolution. Here we go. All right.
No, it was definitely stimulating.
Yeah, you know, but I was skeptical, though, because like I haven't seen these people. It's in the news. That's why they're here, you know.
Well, it also became kind of like a summer trip for a lot of
people. What it offered a benefit. There was a lot of people out of work. They were on unemployment, so they had some money, but, you know, rent's high. But this is a way you could travel all around the country for nothing, you know, if you offer a benefit. Because that's who revolution starts with, the working class, because they're downtrodden and you know, they get real benefits from it. Middle class revolution generally doesn't come from them so much because they've already got it, you know, and the upper class got everything. So they're the upper class fight revolution.
Yeah.
And we have a lot of upper class in this town because it's very expensive to live here.
Well, it surprised me. I think the first time it came from George Bush about class warfare, and it's like, wow, they even took away in meaning
what it means, yeah.
Class, right?
Like, for them, it's that they're taking away the money they stolen from us.
Yeah, and I mean they you know, seize the day and
they call it redistributing wealth too. They're the ones who redistributed away from the people that created it. You know, just because they claim they own the land and everything. And that's to me, that's why it's Free the Land is the show, is because that's where repression starts. I mean, why do you have to pay hundreds of dollars a month just to exist? That's fucking bullshit. Complete bullshit. But everybody accepts it. You know,
you see,
the sanctity of land. Yeah, yeah. I mean, because they didn't make the land. You know, it was here forever. You know, they stole it from the people that used to have it with murder. You know, so to me, that's not legitimate title. So, and why are they, you
right.
know, they make it illegal for you to sleep on the land now if you have nowhere else to sleep? They criminalized being poor. It's fucking bullshit. It should be redistributed every year.
Well, that was, I suppose, one of the benefits of socialism or
communism and the anarchists both believe that the land should be, you know, distributed.
Yeah, you're paying what, a third of your income.
You shouldn't have to pay any of your income for land.
Well, but for rent, when you think about rent.
Well, all right, if they built a building, okay, they did something for that. So if you're going to rent their building, okay, maybe you should pay for that. But like in a park, like Occupy?
Oh, right.
Yeah, and that land was there for centuries, you know, forever, you know, millions of years. And they come in and say, I own this, now you have to pay me to be here. It's fucking bullshit.
But real estate is a big issue in the world, I think.
Yeah, that's where most of your millionaires come from.
Yeah.
Is real, and that's just oppression, period. That's, nothing but oppression.
You know, in terms of resources, real estate is... Mm-hmm. You go to war for real estate.
Yeah, and the resources come out of, like I said, the natural resources. They fight over that because you can sell it and everything. Like in England, you used to be able to sleep on the commons and everything, and it was open to people to graze their flocks until wool. You could export. There it is, globalization again. They could export wool and make a bunch of money off it. And so then they started fencing off the commons. There was no tragedy. The tragedy of the common was capitalism. It took it away.
Tom Hartman always refers to the commons. Taking back the commons.
It's our land, you know. It's not fucking owned by private.
Yeah.
You know, it's owned by humanity in general. not by a few people that have used violence to keep us off it. And that's what happened at Occupy. You see here, you know, you saw a line of, what, 80 police, you know, all their riot gear just swept through, stole everyone's personal property and threw it away to protect the park, where it's actually legal to camp. But there could be another Occupy there tomorrow. As long as you're doing First Amendment activity, it's legal to be at where Occupy was camping. I'm ranting now. Sorry about that.
That's all right. I think I'm going to take off.
Yeah, it's about an hour.
Thanks for inviting me.
Yeah, thanks for coming.
Yeah. Put this back here.
This is Free the Land for August 20th, 2013. Been talking to Gene, who feeds the people.
Take care.
You too.